Good morning. Welcome to the Senate Workforce Committee. I want to welcome everybody here today to your Capitol. And today is February 1st, 2017, and I'll call to order the first Senate Committee on Workforce. We're going to go ahead and start with some introductions. It's a customary thing that we do here in the legislature. When we start each legislative session in each of our committees, we introduce ourselves. Usually the folks who are most interested in the committee are the ones that are here on the first day. So we expect you to come to every single meeting after this. No, I'm just joking. So we're going to go ahead and have people talk, to say who they are, maybe what committees they serve on, and just a little bit about yourself if you feel like it. And we'll go ahead and we'll start with our newest member, Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bill Hansel. I represent District 29, which is the northeast, north central district in the state of Oregon. I have seven counties, six full counties, starting with Hell's Canyon and going all the way to the Dalles Dam. I grew up in Athena, Oregon, where I still live, a little rural farming community of about 1,100 people. I've just started my second term and in the Senate. I was 30 years a Umatilla County Commissioner. And so we as commissioners, local government, dealt with PERS periodically through the years. I serve on, this is the only policy committee I have, but the other two committees are full Ways and Means. And Transportation Economic Development Sub of Ways and Means.
Hi, I'm Lori Monis Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview, and a little bit of East Portland. This committee's going to be new to me. PERS is not new to me, but this committee is. And I chair the Senate Healthcare Committee. I serve on the Veterans and Human Services Committee also.
Okay, well, I'll go last. Sarah, go.
So I'm Senator Sarah Gelster. I represent Corvallis, Albany, Philomath, and the areas in that region. I serve, in addition to this committee, on the Education Committee, on the Human Services Sub of the Ways and Means Committee, and I'm the chair of the Human Services Committee.
Tim Canope. I represent Bend, Sun River, Tumalo, and Redmond. And I serve on the Human Services Committee with Chair Gelser, and I also serve on the Healthcare Committee with Chair Monis Anderson. And, of course, I'm the Vice Chair of this committee and look forward to a productive session.
Great. And I'm going to go ahead and have Deborah introduce herself.
I'm Deborah Marianov. I'm the Legislative Analyst to the committee, and I serve all of the members on this committee.
So Deborah is very modest, and she's also a lawyer and a PhD, and has served as a clerk for Judge Wolheim. Mm-hmm. Yes, and so she is more than qualified to assist us through this process. So I'm Senator Kathleen Taylor. I represent Southeast Portland, and Milwaukee, and Oak Grove. I just finished my first term over in the House, and then new to the Senate, so freshman again. And I'm looking forward to working with my colleagues and addressing the various serious issues that we have before us for the session. So as for next steps, I'm going to go ahead and open an organizational meeting for the purpose of adopting the committee rules. This will just take a moment, folks. So
would you like me to make a motion?
Yes.
I move to adopt the committee rules for the Senate Workforce Committee.
Thank you, Vice Chair Cope. Canope moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 1st, 2017. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes and the rules are adopted. So I hereby close the organizational meeting. We will not be having a work session today. So we are going to open a work session for the purpose of introducing committee bills. As a reminder, a vote to introduce a measure does not designate support for the substance of the measure. It serves only to allow for the proposal to be introduced. So I will turn it over. I ask a member.
Do you have a dilemma? Yes. Madam Chair, I move LC 4143 dated 1/31/17 be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay, thank you. Chair Senator Canope moves that the following LC 4143 be introduced as committee bill. dated 1/31/17. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there further discussion, objections? If not, the measures are introduced as committee bills. Go ahead and close the work session. Okay, now the next step is we're going to open an informational hearing for the purposes of hearing from the Oregon Public Retirement, Public Employees Retirement System, opening the informational hearing. So as a little background for those who are interested in what's happening here, last Friday, Senator Canope and I sent out a memo that is on OLIS. And what this memo does is it lays out criteria that we would like our colleagues in the legislature and folks who have legislative concepts that they want to bring forward regarding PERS, that they look at the criteria that we've put forward and look at their bills and say, okay, well, it's my bill concept actually, or the actual bill that they may have in the format, meet the criteria for it to be considered by the committee. So there is a structure around as bills will be evaluated by our committee. One is to meet the criteria on the document that was released on Friday, and then in addition, there'll be a technical committee that will review the bills to determine their viability. And that technical committee will consist of, but not be limited to, the PERS, the staff, and therefore that means the actuaries that will be hired under PERS, and in addition, LFO, and then, of course, legislative counsel here. And then if we need additional expertise to look at a bill concept, then we will bring those additional experts in to evaluate them. So I just wanted to lay out what the format is. We've put a deadline on for the end of this month, February 28th, for bills to be brought forward for the committee to evaluate if folks want to address something around PERS. The idea is for this to be an open discussion, and it's the first day of the legislative session. This is something that is on the public's mind, and so we want to have an open dialogue and have it be very transparent. And we're going to be looking at this, getting really into the weeds, and so that's why we're going to start today. For the first two meetings, we're going to have the actual PERS, the director of PERS, and staff talk to us about what what's currently happening with PERS, the financial situation that the state is in, and then to talk probably more on Monday about the constitutional, whether or not some of the bills and the bills that we've had in the past, some of the constitutional challenges we've had to date. So, did I cover everything, Deborah?
Yes.
Before we go forward. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and call Steve Rodman, the PERS Executive Director, to come up for an overview. And then did you want to join? Oh, so, okay, well, that's up to you. He's going to give us a presentation on the legislative history of PERS and the financial status. So as for questions, because there'll be questions along the way. I'm sorry, sir?
I want to just, we have a senator here. Does she, I don't know if you saw Betsy Johnson.
Oh, I did not see you, Senator Johnson. You were sitting behind. All right, would you like to come join us on the dais?
For the offer of the courtesy, Madam Chair, I'm going to stay right here.
Oh, well, then we won't be able to have your witty comments. So it would be much more fun if you came and joined us. You want to?
May I reconsider and I'll bring my witty comments? And
I would love it if you came and joined us, Senator Johnson. It would be very much appreciated because we need to have a little bit of fun as we go through this. So, Mr. Rodman, do you have everything you need? Are you set to go?
I am.
Okay, great. We'll go ahead and have you get started.
So thank you, Chair Taylor, and for the members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Rodman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Employees Retirement System. And thank you for the opportunity to come and spend a fair amount of time to explain the background of PERS, what's developed over time, and where we are at today. So I'll start with a system overview. We have three different programs for retirees that we administer through our agency, and the different benefit levels for each. The different benefit levels for each define basically the amount of benefits that can be derived through the service for public employees. So the different programs are delineated by when a member started in public service. So Tier 1 members are those who started their public service prior to 1996. and that is since the inception of the program in 1945 up through 1996. Starting January 1 of 96, people who started public employment after that date are in Tier 2. And I'll go through the differences between these programs when we get to the chart itself. Just want to get the dates out. And then lastly, the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, or OPSERP, is the most recent stratus of membership that was created for members who joined public employment starting in August of 2003. So the chart lays out the different components of benefits for each of these programs, and I want to walk through the comparison so you understand sort of how the evolution has occurred as these programs came into play and where the differences are. So starting with Tier 1 and normal retirement age, and Chair, as you said, if you have any questions as we go through, please feel free to interrupt me. But starting with normal retirement age, Tier 1 members have what is called a normal retirement age at age 58. So at age 58, that is when a Tier 1 member is eligible to retire and receive their full benefit. We note there about police and fire, or what we call PNF. PNF members are people who are classified as working either as police or firefighters under statutory definitions by their employer, and PNF members are eligible to retire earlier. Generally, they are physically demanding positions that have shorter careers. So PNF members in Tier 1 can retire at age 55 or with 25 years of service. When Tier 2 came along in 1996, that retirement age was raised. So instead of normal retirement age being age 58 in Tier 2, the normal retirement age is 60. And in OPSERP, that was raised again to age 65. So what that means from a retirement program is an earlier age means the benefits will be paid out longer. So the cost of those benefits for Tier 1, even if it's the same amount of benefits, they're going to be higher for Tier 1 because they're paid over a longer expected lifespan. Early retirement is also available. That's generally at age 55. Early retirement to us means that if someone chooses to retire before normal retirement age, we actuarially adjust their benefit downward so that if they retire early, they get less of a benefit but for more years. So those are supposed to be actuarially equivalent when we make our adjustment.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Steve, what happens to the pension plan, let's say OPSERP, if the retirement age is raised from, say, 65 to, what's Social Security, 67 now?
Currently 67, yeah.
So what happens to the plan in terms of cost and unfunded liability if the retirement age is raised?
Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Canope, the answer, of course, is it depends. So... let's say, just for example, that the higher retirement age comes for people who join the system after this point in time forward. Because, let's say, 67, that means 2 years of benefits would not have to be paid compared to somebody who's 65. That would be less expensive. I don't know an order of magnitude. I'd have to check on that with our actuaries. But the later someone is eligible for normal retirement, the less expensive that benefit is for the retirement system. Okay. So benefit calculation methods, let's spend a fair amount of time on that because that can also get confusing. So in Tier 1, there are three methods by which we calculate a member's benefit. And to be very clear, the method that we use to actually pay the member's benefit is the result of the highest of these three methods. So the member does not get to choose which of these methods are used to calculate their benefit, but rather we calculate the benefit each of these ways, and whichever results in the higher benefit is the one that the member receives. So the money match benefit is the method that was originally in place with PERS. We started as a money match system in 1945. And under the money match system, what happens is the member makes contributions to their account, their regular account, over the course of their career. And then at retirement, the balance in that account, which are the accumulated member's contributions and any earnings that they've accrued over that time, is matched by the funds of their employer over their careers. So a member who has, let's say, a $200,000 regular account, at retirement, $200,000 would be paid from the account reserves of the employers that member worked for over their career, and then that combined dollar amount, $400,000, would be paid out to the member as an annuity over the member's lifetime. So money matches the way the system was created. Money matches the way that we operated up until sometime in the late 60s. I think it was 1967. In 1967, the legislature said, there's another method we want you to use, and that's what's called formula plus annuity. In the formula plus annuity method, the formula piece refers to a calculation of a base pension. And that formula in the Formula Plus Annuity program is the same as other basic retirement formulas, meaning there's three things that we use. We use the years of service that the member has. We use their final salary, which can be determined under a number of different scenarios we're going to talk about. And we use a statutory factor or a multiplier. For Formula Plus Annuity, that multiplier is 1%. So the formula plus annuity calculation set the pension on that formula basis, and then the annuity was the payment of the member's account. That was a new method, I say, that came in, I think, in 1967. Then in 1979, the legislature added another method, which is called the full formula method. And that full formula method just uses those three elements I talked about, the years of service, final salary, and then the factor was raised to 1.67. So the factor of 1.67 means a 30-year career that's put in by a public employee would yield a 50% final average salary as their retirement benefit. 30 years times 1.67, 50% of your final average salary. So like I say, that was brought in 1979. So those three methods are still used to apply to a Tier 1 method. The Formula Plus Annuity, you had to have actually worked before 1981 to be eligible for that. So mostly it's the two methods we have now, money match and full formula, that we calculate every individual member's Tier 1 member's retirement under those two methods, pay them the higher of those two. In Tier 2, the same two methods are available, money match and full formula. Formula plus annuity, like I say, is prior to 1981. And then in OPSERP, there is no money match. It is only a full formula benefit. So in OPSERP, the only way you get a benefit is determined by the amount of your benefit. It's determined by your salary and your years of service, and then a lower multiplier or statutory factor. The benefit factor for Tier 1 and Tier 2, 1.67, 1.5. for OPSERP. So a 30-year career in OPSERP pays you 45% of your final average salary, not 50% as you get with Tier 1 or Tier 2. Factors are slightly higher for police and fire, again, owing to the fact that they have shorter careers. So the factors are slightly higher so that the shorter years of service will still yield roughly the same benefit as a full career from a public employee. Those benefits are referred to generally as the pension, and those benefits are paid for predominantly by contributions from employers. So how those benefits get funded is important to understand as well when you talk about the relative risk for the cost of those benefits. The way that Tier 1 and Tier 2 benefits are calculated, because Tier 1 and Tier 2 members have regular accounts and variable accounts. But because those member accounts exist, the first step we do when a member retires is we annuitize their account, similar to what I described in the money match methodology. We annuitize their account, and then we determine what their retirement benefit is. And the gap between what the member's account pays for and what the benefit is to which they're entitled is paid by the employer. So to the extent that member accounts do not fund at least half of the benefit, the member is going to go full formula, because if the member account funded half of what they're entitled to, the employer pays the other half. If the member account only pays a third of what they're entitled to, the employer pays the other two-thirds. So why I'm belaboring that is because those member accounts used to fund a portion of the benefit. But in 2004, for reasons we'll explain when we get into the changes in the 2003 PERS reforms, contributions stopped going to those member accounts. So those member accounts stopped receiving member contributions in 2003. Instead, member accounts go into the individual account program, or the IAP. So all Tier 1, Tier 2, and OPSERP members who had service after 2004 had that member contribution go into their individual account. What that has meant over time, because member accounts, remember, regular accounts in Tier 1, Tier 2 stopped growing as quickly, what that has meant over time is that money match is a less and less predominant method by which member benefits are determined. Full formula is much more common now than it was when the 2003 PERS reforms were passed, and I'll talk more about that on the second day. For OPSERP, they never had a regular account. OPSERP has always had an IAP, which is where the member contribution has gone, and a pension, which is that full formula type calculation. So in 2003, when OPSERP was created, the legislature who creates the benefit structure said employers will be responsible for the risk and costs associated with the pension under OPSERP. Members will be responsible for the risk and costs associated with the IAP, because how much your IAP contributes to your retirement depends on how much you earn over time. What is the rate of return that you get on your IAP? So the IAP has no, or the return for the IAP varies with the market. So investment returns and losses are credited to the IAP every year. I'll pause there and see if there's any questions. Seeing none, I'll keep
going. Well, just a real quick question.
Sure.
If a person doesn't work a full 30 years, say they work 20 years, is the percentage of what everything is based on, is it widely different than if you're 30 years?
Chair Taylor, Senator Monis Anderson. So despite running a retirement system, I can't do that complex math in my head. But 30 years times 1.67 is 50%. You would do the same thing, 20 years times 1.67, okay, which is less than 50.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So it all depends, again, on years of service, statutory factor, times your final salary. So how do we determine final salary? The rules are different for Tier 1, Tier 2, and OPSERP. Under Tier 1, there are two factors that we include in the final average salary. One is what is called a lump sum vacation payout. You get to the end of your career, you have 100 hours of vacation that you couldn't use, so your employer pays you for that 100 hours of vacation. That lump sum vacation payout at the end of your career is included in your final salary for Tier 1 members. For the other factor for Tier 1 that's included to increase the final salary is unused sick leave. If your employer decided to participate in the unused sick leave program, which is only to say not every employer did, but if your employer did, then half of your unused sick leave at retirement counts towards your final salary. So those are two mechanisms not associated with your salary necessarily or directly that can serve to increase, or some would say inflate, your final average salary. For Tier 2 members, those lump sum vacation payouts are not included in your final salary. You still get 6% member contributions to your IAP on them, but you do not get that lump sum vacation payout included in your final salary, and you still get unused sick leave in Tier 2. For OPSERP, neither of those factors are used or have an influence on your final average salary. So, what have been the results of this over time? I wanted to set something of a baseline as to the results of running the system as we have and who gets paid how much.
Madam Chair.
yes, hi. I'm sorry. Nice to see you.
If you would indulge a question, because this comes up repeatedly when I'm talking to folks. Back on the last slide, when you're talking about final salary, how the salary is calculated as to source. Let's assume that a person is part of a university, and the money, their salary is reflected in a university paycheck. But then there is supplemental income, say from a foundation or an athletic association or some outside source, maybe even grants for researchers. How are those extraordinary amounts of money, and by extraordinary I don't mean unusual, but I mean they're not the salary, but they are supplemental too. How are those calculated, and what's the effect on the system, and what would happen if they were not calculated?
Chair Taylor, Senator Johnson, you're going to get tired of hearing this. The answer again is it depends. And what it depends on is generally the salary definition says that salary is money paid to an employee from funds of the employer. So it's not directive as to the sorts of supplemental sources of revenue that you're talking about. Whether then those supplemental sources translate into a higher salary depends on how the employer treats that money. So let's say that a university professor receives a grant, and the funds of those grant come into the university, and the university pays that to the professor, or uses those funds to pay the professor's salary. Then it would count as salary paid by funds of the employer and count towards their final average salary. Instead, let's say that professor has a grant that they've achieved that is paid directly to that professor. That direct payment from the grant provider does not count towards their final salary or their salary for PERS purposes.
Follow up. And is there any opportunity for adjustment in that arena? What I'm trying to figure out is, and I'm making these numbers up, researcher paid $100,000 and a grant comes in for $1 million to do specific research. It is paid to the university foundation, and some portion of that then goes to the professor or the researcher. That would be calculated as the researcher's final salary, even though it might be considerably more than the base salary?
Chair Taylor, Senator Johnson, to parse that out, the foundation is probably not a PERS participating employer. The university is. So the foundation being, I'm assuming, like a charitable endowment, would not be a participating employer. So if the endowment or the foundation paid that professor, that does not count towards PERS.
One more follow-up. Yes. Even if it is a foundation organized as a supporting foundation, and again, I'm just using this as an example, Oregon State University has an Oregon State University Foundation. They're two undoubtedly separate legal entities. But when the purpose of the foundation is to supplement university activities.
Senator Taylor, Senator Johnson, I don't know for sure, because we have to dig into that relationship and whether that foundation itself is a public employer, which we do. When we see salary being reported that is anomalous, that's one of the things we inquire about, is what is the source of the salary. The point, though, is that's really driven by the employer's determination of whether what we're paying this individual to do is being paid from funds of the employer. And so I can't speak specifically to the OSU Foundation. I don't know how they're legally structured, but I could see where that foundation is perhaps not an employer in PERS. And consequently, whatever would be paid out of that foundation would not count. If the foundation paid OSU, and OSU then paid the professor, it would count. But that's OSU's determination.
Thank you.
How prevalent is it, and how much does it drive up costs? I haven't looked at that because we really don't have any way to distinguish the report that comes from any employer as to the source of the money that they use to pay those salaries.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. Yes. I guess what I'm focused on is the supplemental salary in athletic departments, and I understand the recruiting benefits, and I understand the ramifications that ripple out from all of the athletic success, but in some cases, those are exorbitant salaries versus a traditional state employee. And I'm just trying to figure out, those are very rare instances, but I'm just trying to tease out the effect on the system where you have somebody with a $5 or $6 or $7 million or more salary.
Chair Taylor, Senator Johnson, one of the things, of course, to keep in mind is that all the members in Tier 2 and OPSERP have a salary limitation, which is imposed and parallels the Federal Internal Revenue Code limitation on retirement benefits, which for 2017 is $270,000 a year. So that limitation certainly would limit, wherever the source of money comes from the employer, how much counts towards that individual salary.
Thank you.
So moving on, and this, Senator Johnson, may illustrate a little bit to you about the impact of such salaries in comparison to the system as a whole. I just spend a little time on this chart to focus on really the level of benefits that that is provided through the system. Is, as you mentioned, Senator Johnson, there are these individuals in the system, and they can't tend to catch the attention. They are anomalies. They are certainly not the usual. If you look at the pie chart in the upper left, two-thirds of our members receive less than $3,000 a month in retirement benefits. And then the other next biggest slice of the pie are people receiving between $3,000 to $6,000 in retirement benefits. Add those two together, 94% of the people in PERS receive less than $6,000 a month in retirement benefits. The anomalies, as you point out, Senator Johnson, are in that 5% or even maybe the 0.74% of benefit recipients who receive more than $9,000 a month from PERS. Yes, they exist. The only thing I would note about their existence and the driving of the cost of the system is their very small numbers. And in a system this large, what really drives the cost of PERS is not that there's a few people out there that get a lot of money. There's a lot of people that get a little bit more than they otherwise would, and we'll talk about how we got to that point.
Just a quick question.
Yes.
And maybe the number is insignificant, but for the 6% that get a lot, what percentage of the overall payout to all PERS and retirees is it significant? I mean, when you're saying $500 to $600 million a year, and if there's 100 people out of the entire PERS system that get that amount, I mean, is it a huge percentage of the payout?
So, Chair Taylor, Senator Monis Anderson, I'm referencing a document we call PERS by the Numbers, which is up on our website. We maintain and update this every 6 months because it has a lot of those kinds of answers to it. So I'm really glad I grabbed a copy of it before I came today. So just in that last slice, the 0.74% of recipients who are over 9,000 who receive more than 9,000 a month, that's 0.74% of the recipients. It represents 3% of the benefits paid. 3.34% of the benefits paid.
Thank you.
And that's the comparison in this chart between the orange, which shows you the number of people, and the blue line, which shows you the percentage of benefits paid. So average benefits, this is just a legend up in the right about an average annual benefit being $29,000. That's the people who are retiring currently. And then the median is 23,000. Almost 135,000 members of PERS are in this monthly benefit status. That includes not only the people who retired, but also their beneficiaries, or what we call alternate PEs, which is if there was a divorce and there was a split of the benefit. That's the number of people we send, mostly electronic transfers, but sometimes, yes, checks to every month. So where does that money come from? PERS has been funded predominantly through investment returns. And again, this is important to understand as far as where the dynamics of the system are driven. So the pie chart shows you that out of all of the money that we have collected for PERS from 1970 to 2015, 73% of that is investment income. So the PERS fund that is invested through the Oregon Investment Council has generated 73 cents of every dollar that we have to pay benefits. Employer contributions represent 21.1% of the money that we have, member contributions 5.5%, and that slice of the pie for member contributions, those are the member contributions prior to 2003 that went into the member's regular or variable account. So what this shows is how highly dependent the system is on investment returns, and what a big driver of the health of the system in relative terms is driven by how well did the OIC return the funds that it invested. So the other point to make is the table, which shows the system's funded status. It's broken down a couple of different ways, and I want to spend a little more time on that too, so you understand those different components. These are funded statuses as of the end of the calendar year. And starting in 2009, the funded status of the system was 86%, including side accounts, 76%, excluding side accounts. What are side accounts? Side accounts are lump sum deposits that individual employers have decided to make with the system. So State of Oregon, for example, issued some pension obligation bonds in 2003, and the proceeds of those bonds were placed in the PERS fund. So why, in the case of the State of Oregon, they made this decision was pension obligation bonds were issued at a very low price. The rate that they had to pay to borrow that money through the bond system was relatively low compared to the return that they project to get from investing that money. So it's basically borrowing home equity to see if you can invest that in the stock market and make more than it's going to cost you for your home equity loan. The answer is, if you're really good, you can. The answer also depends on when did you do it. Now, the State of Oregon did it in 2003. We had large investment returns in 2003, 2004, 5, 6, 7, ran up a large balance on their pension obligation, on their side account. When the market turned in 2008, the gap between how much could be taken out of that side account and the cost for the pension obligation bond narrowed, but they're still ahead of the game. Whether that was a successful strategy really can't be determined until we get to the end of the bond amortization period, which is out in 2027. But so far, the State of Oregon timed that well. There were other employers that didn't issue their pension obligation bonds until 2007. So the first thing that happened is they lost 28% in the PERS fund. That's a hole that's going to be very difficult for them to dig out of. So timing is important. For my purposes, what I do with that side account is I amortize it off over the period of time of the pension obligation bond it's matched to. And what I do is I take contributions, employer contributions, off of that pension obligation bond every time I bill the employer. So effectively it means the employer has a lower PERS rate because there are advanced contributions that I'm taking over time to match the payment cycle of the bond. For my purposes, when I look at the funded status of the system, those side accounts are in the PERS fund. They cannot be touched. They cannot be refunded. They are my money. You can't have it, whoever you, the employer, are. So when I look at funded status, starting again in 2009, I'm 86% funded. When we do employer contribution calculations, we strip out those side accounts because they're amortized over time, and that's where you see the number excluding side accounts, what the funded status is. So in 79, the funded status was 76% without counting those side accounts. That's the funded status we use then to set the employer contribution rates when we do that.
But is that in the best interest, though? I mean, does it really make that big of a difference to take that out?
Well, Chair Taylor, Senator Monson-Anderson, that's how we determine the pure contribution rate, and then we reduce the actual rate based on the contributions that will come off of the side account.
So if we didn't do that, the contribution would actually be more for the employer.
For that employer, yes. And that's how they get benefit of having the side account with us, is we use that to offset their contributions over time.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Steve, how many entities, public entities, went ahead and bonded their PERS debt, like you described in 2007?
Chair Taylor, Senator Knope, there are very few in 2007. I don't remember exactly, but it's only like four or five, I think. Okay. Most of them did it back in 2003, four or five.
Okay. Follow-up?
Yes.
Has anybody done it since?
Chair Taylor, Senator Knope, I don't think so. I know what I read in the papers. So by that, I know Salem-Keizer School District talked about it a year ago, and I think got authority to issue a pension obligation bond, but to my knowledge, they have not done that.
Follow up?
Yes.
So based on what you said, it makes a whole lot more sense if you are bonding at the bottom of the market versus the top of the market. Would that be a true statement?
Yes.
Okay.
I have a question of how long will it take for those to be paid off, the bonds that are in existence now?
So the vintage years, if you will, Chair Taylor, were around this 2004, 5, 6 period. We amortized all of them out to 2027. So by that I mean we adjust the side account amortization so that it's going to run out in 2027, which is also when we told all those entities that issued the bonds, that's how long you're going to get benefit for this. I think predominantly then that's how they matched their bond repayment process, but it was an individual decision. I can't speak for every single one of them.
Okay. Senator Johnson?
You pointed out the investment income at 73.4% and how reliant this system is on the investment income. How concerned should I be that, and you also mentioned, you used the acronym OIC, the Oregon Investment Council, how concerned should I be, or any of us be, that the retiring chair, a 12-year member of the Oregon Investment Council, has written a letter discussing the frailty of this kind of funding mechanism? It's been widely reported in the press, and I just want to know how anxious the professional PERS managers are at the alarm that Ms. Durant sounded.
Chair Taylor, Senator Johnson, the calculus we make on this investment income and its relative contribution to the funding of the system is what we call the assumed rate. And the assumed rate is, what do we think our investments are going to earn over the next 20 years? That is a determination that we make every 2 years, and I'll explain that in more detail when I get into the system funding equation. But we are certainly mindful of the fact that the return environment currently is challenged by the Federal Reserve's low rate policy, and I think any investment professional that I've heard over the period of time since 2008 has said what the Fed is doing can't last. The argument or the reality has been, I think it has persisted longer than anyone expected. So when we look at this assumed rate, it's a 20-year projection, and that 20-year projection has always, since 2008, had a low growth at the start. I think what we're learning, and we will review again in this summer, is how long will that low period persist? It's persisted longer than most people thought. So how alarmed should you be? I hope you're not too alarmed, because you take some solace in the fact that we look at this every 2 years. And it is, when I say it's this assumed rate discussion. And it's driven by the expertise of the investment professionals that advise first the Oregon Investment Council and then the PERS board. So by that I mean there are other systems where the assumed rate is held at an artificially high rate because it's a political decision, not an administrative decision. And that's always been one of the benefits of Oregon PERS is the administration of the system is predominantly in the hands of the PERS board and the Oregon Investment Council. So Chair Durant's concerns are well-founded given the rate environment. They will be reflected in the decisions that the OIC and the PERS board make in short order.
Follow.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
Given the volatility of the markets and the business vicissitudes, is 2 years adequate? Or, I mean, should it be more frequent to do the assumed rate analysis?
Chair Taylor, Senator Johnson, we are a long-term investor, and we have a long-term view. The chart I show you about PERS funding here shows that we're within a range of percentages. The volatility that you're talking about doesn't get directly reflected in the really highs and real lows of the system. So you have to take that long-term view, because otherwise you drive yourself crazy. Every day the market changes, and back in earlier times, I always refer back to Senator Canope and us in 2003. Back in earlier times, we would get questions almost every day we walked in the Capitol, what's the UAL today? You know, back then we didn't have smartphones and I couldn't check the markets that rapidly. But the long-term view is really what is important in planning the system. The share of system income that comes from investments is pretty persistent. It's not like it goes from 70 to 30 to 20. It's been around 70% for a long time.
That was helpful. Thank you.
Okay. So another dynamic of the system to keep in mind, particularly as you talk about changes to it, is who is eligible to retire. This is what we call our golden handshake report. And as you see, there is a large percentage of PERS members who are currently eligible to retire, and it isn't just tier ones. I'm always amazed when I look at the OPSERP group and see how many people who are eligible to retire at age 65. Because that is normal retirement age in OPSERP, but it is still a large number of folks out of state agencies, schools, local government, community colleges, of folks that could retire out of the system. So we are mindful of this for a couple of reasons. Always, of course, we're waiting to see what is the trigger that sends these people running in our doors, because we want to be sure we're prepared to process the retirement requests for those folks that we do get. The other thing that we keep in mind in this is when we get to talking about legislative concepts and Chair Taylor, the analysis you want us to do on the ideas that are brought forward, you have to be mindful of how many of these people will be triggered by whatever concept you're talking about, and therefore how much of the savings are you actually going to capture if you're looking for savings by reduction in benefits. Because if you pass a law that says you're going to reduce the benefits on this cohort and the cohort knows that and retires before the legislation is effective, you've lost your savings. Thank you. So, overview of PERS and partnerships. We, the agency, administer a system, and I want to make sure that everyone's clear on the fact that the system is public employment. We often get referred to as the state retirement system, or that we only serve state agencies. In fact, the state as an employer is a relatively small share of our employer group. States, universities, and judges represent about 60,000 of the members, active members that we have. This is in the lower left of that slide. School districts are more like 85,000. So by far our largest share of members come out of the school districts, K through 12. Local government, which is cities, counties, special districts, those folks are about 70,000, a little over 70,000 of our membership. So PERS is really it needs to be considered a public employee retirement system, not just a state retirement system. So when you talk about dynamics, Senator Johnson, as you did, about the universities and the professors, yes, they're in the mix, but they're a relatively small share across the broad spectrum of public employees. By program, as we said, Tier 1 is the oldest, but by far the smallest number of members still left in the system, active members left in the system. Tier 2 is 54,000. OPSERP, just in the 13 years or so it's been in existence, already comprises the largest share of our membership. More than 50% of folks are in OPSERP. So the dynamics change in the system as far as membership pretty quickly after the 03 reforms, but the liabilities are something that are still catching up to that. So the funding equation. This is something I usually spend a fair amount of time on because I think it tells us a couple of things. One, it's a fundamental equation that every retirement system has to solve, and we solve it every year in Oregon PERS. And it's a simple equation that illustrates the dynamics, I think, of the system very well. So the other thing I like about it is it may be math, but it's only algebra. So algebra, everything on the left side of the equation has to be the same as the right side of the equation. So the B, in this case, the benefits, has to equal contributions plus earnings. It's a fundamental equation for any retirement system because the benefits, what are owed to members, has to be paid for by contributions and earnings. So we look at this relative balance every year. We conduct what's called a system valuation. And when I say we retain our professional actuaries to do this work. They look at the end of every calendar year, what are the benefits that are promised to people? And that's not only people who are in retirement, it is people who have put work in to that date that are entitled to a benefit. So what are the benefits that are promised to the members of the system? And what is the present value of those benefits? Present value meaning if you took this stream of payments that's due out in the future, how much in dollars do you need today to fund that benefit stream out into the future? That B in the equation or benefits is controlled by the legislature. The legislature sets the terms and conditions of the plan and determines who's going to get paid how much out of PERS. The funding, then, of those benefits has to come from only two sources, contributions and earnings. Earnings are the return on the investments of the fund. So not only the returns that we've received to date, but the returns that we expect over the next 20 years based on the asset allocations that the Oregon Investment Council has set. So the E in this is future returns based on how those funds will be invested over 20 years. Contributions, then, are the swing funder, meaning when the B and the C plus E do not align, the PERS board changes the C to make this formula come back into balance. Because as much as we'd like to say we can direct what the E will be, the E is the market, and you cannot predict with any certainty what the market will do. As Senator Johnson said, it's quite volatile, changes a lot from one time to the next. So to smooth that out, to even out the funding, the contributions that are set by the PERS board.
Yes, Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair. Steve, I mean, part of the reason we're doing this is for education purposes. So I want to focus a little bit on the E part of it. And you've seen this crediting Excel spreadsheet, I imagine.
Yeah.
Before. And it's on OLIS. I put it on OLIS. And I think it's really important for people to understand why the problem exists today. And so if you look at the earnings of the fund from 1979 to 1999, you have number that was earned, and for Tier 1, we all know that's an 8% guarantee.
It's an assumed rate guarantee. For much of that time, it was 8%.
Right, exactly. But there is a guarantee for Tier 1, right?
Right.
And so what happened during that time period was that instead of crediting employee accounts 8% or 7.5%, because it was at 7.5% during some of that time period, they were credited substantially more than that. And if they hadn't been credited that, that money would have gone into the gain loss reserve, most likely. And so essentially what happened was over that 20-year period, $3.183 billion was credited to employee accounts essentially before it was known what was going to be earned in the following years. So if you don't put money into the gain loss reserve, you don't have the money when the stock market is minus 21, but you still owe the employee 8%, that's a lot of money. So during that period, a lot of money was put into employee accounts that really should have been in the gain loss reserve. And I don't blame public employees for that, but I sure blame the PERS board, the legislature, and the governor for not acting for 20 years.
Chair Taylor, Senator Canope, I'm not sure if there was a question in there, but I'll take it as a preview of coming attractions. In the second day, as I get to the explanation of what has driven the dynamics of why the system is where they are at today, it is precisely because of that crediting pattern that it led to the level of benefits that we have today, and why that's persisting.
Yeah, I mean we can call it a mistake, but it's a generational thing that is also hard to make up when, you know, your earnings aren't going to be like they were in 2003, 4, and 5, where it was, what, close to 20% for 4 or 5 years in a row.
Right. And I would, again, just note, Chair Taylor, Senator Canope, that's page 15 of PERS by the numbers. There's a lot of good information in there.
There is. So just to follow up to that, so the 2016 earnings, do we know what those are?
Chair Taylor, Senator Canope, we did preliminary earnings crediting last Friday. They were preliminarily, the crediting was at 7.12% generally across the Tier 2 Employer and Benefits of Force Reserve, which is below our assumed rate of 7.5.
The heck of a lot closer than
2.11. Sorry?
It's better than 2.11 in, what, 15?
From 15, yes.
Yeah, okay.
I just wanted to follow up. So in this spreadsheet here, is this adjusted, or I'm not seeing the reference point of, so from 1979 to 1999, these amounts, it doesn't have the detail there.
So no. That's the difference. So
no, but are these all adjusted?
Adjusted how?
Over time. So these, you're saying that's the total
dollar. That's the cumulative.
That's cumulative. But fixed. Then what would it be?
That's not including interest. It would be much bigger.
Yeah. No, I understand. Okay. And so were there any actions during that time taken to rein that in, or discussions that you know of that occurred? Or, I mean, maybe were people aware of it and they just couldn't take action at the time, or?
Chair Taylor, can I talk? I can either skip ahead in the presentation.
Okay, we'll wait. We'll just table this for now.
We're going to talk about it.
I know you have your presentation, so I want to be respectful of that. So let's just stick with what
you have. I can go.
And then we'll come back to this later. It sounds like we'll talk about it.
Let's have a reason to come back Monday.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I just want to understand why maybe that wasn't addressed.
Back to the formula, benefits, contributions, earnings, understanding the balance of it, understanding, again, the responsible parties, the legislature being responsible for the B, employers, the contributions at this point. OIC manages the earnings, but really can't direct what that is. So just on the history of the B a little bit, as Senator Canope has previewed, a lot of the situation of where we've gotten to today with PERS has to do with those crediting decisions in the 80s and 90s. But I share these two charts just to show you sort of the attitude and approach around PERS. This chart shows you the changes that have been made to PERS since it was created in 1945. Don't need to get into the details of it. I've talked about a few of them along the way. The main thing I want you to understand is that if the benefits got better, it's green. Look at all the green. For the first 50 years of this system, benefit changes were predominantly enhancements of benefits and additions of benefits over time. If you pivot then after 1995, which will be an important date that we get to when we talk about how we got here today, this is the next 20 years. Look at all the red. So we've been chasing the reductions as a result of the first 50 years of increases.
Question?
Yes, Senator Knopf.
So, Steve, I don't see your chart showing when legislators were added to PERS. When was that?
I don't know, sir. Chair Taylor, Senator Knopf, I don't know when the legislators
were added. It was about 1975.
What was your question?
When legislators were added. It was about 1975.
Okay. This is not every change to PERS. It's really just the main.
No, I know. I know. I just thought it might be helpful.
So the main point I used to illustrate this, again, back to the formula, the benefit piece of this, you as the legislators direct, again, the major movements of the legislation, not necessarily to the crediting that we're going to talk about in more detail, but this is part of my plea to you as an agency director, is understand that every change you make to increase benefits is an addition to the B. Everything that you do is going to make the B, to make benefits bigger, is make that B larger. And it's going to drive, it's got to get paid for, either by contributions or earnings. And so I just want to make sure that's on the record.
Yes, thank you.
So the PERS board, just a quick slide about who they are and what they do. Five members now. From 2003, the board was reduced down to five members. Three of them are independent, have nothing to do with PERS, cannot be a beneficiary or member of the system, but must have expertise in business, pension management, or investing. One member is an employee or a retiree from a bargaining unit. One member is either a management service person from the state or an elective office governing body. So you have an employer rep, a member rep, and three independents on the five-member PERS board. Statutorily, the PERS board is directed to be trustees of the PERS fund and to administer the system for long-term stability and viability. Some of the basic blocking and tackling that they have to accomplish is producing that actuarial report at least once every 2 years. As I say, we do it every year, to evaluate current and prospective assets and liabilities and financial condition. They adopt actuarial equivalency factor tables, meaning tables that are used to convert accounts into annuities. Actuarial equivalency meaning if I pay you this money today in a lump sum or this much over time, actuarially they should be the same amount, even though obviously over time it's going to be more actual dollars to be paid. And lastly, the PERS board is charged with adopting rules and taking actions necessary to maintain PERS as a federal tax qualified retirement plan. We do need to follow federal rules and federal guidelines as far as what a retirement plan can do. And that's an overriding control over some of the decisions that we make in the PERS board and by the system. So the main driver in this conversation as far as the contributions piece in the formula BCE, back to the C, the PERS board follows a deliberative process in establishing those employer contribution rates, and they're built off of those system valuations. So you look at the value, you look at the formula B, C, E. In our current situation, the B is larger than the C plus E. So you have to make the PERS board has to make the C bigger. How much bigger is driven by the delta between those two sides of the equation. You take the valuation in the odd numbered year. So for the rates we're paying in this biennium, they're based on the valuation from December 31 of 2013, went into effect July 1 of 2015. We closed the valuation for December 31 of 15, and then this last fall, the PERS board adopted rates that go into effect July 1 of 17. So there's always that 18-month lag between when does the valuation close and when do the employer contribution rates go into effect. That allows us to do the valuation work. That allows us to communicate to the employers and for them to do their financing and planning so that they know which rates are coming. In solving that equation, in coming up with the contribution rate, there are some basic principles, fundamental principles that the PERS board follows. First, of course, is to be transparent as to process and inputs. And all of the information, of course, that the PERS board uses in its deliberations are up on our website and associated with the meetings where those deliberations occurred. All of the actuarial reports, the PERS by the numbers, the chart that, Senator Canopa is referencing on our return history, all this information is available up on our website. Granted, it's tedious. Granted, it might be hard to get through sometimes. That's kind of why I try to boil down these presentations to the essentials. But transparency of the process and inputs is very important so that people understand what those drivers are. The next two principles are often in conflict, but they're very important ones to follow. We want to be, the PERS board and system, want to provide predictable and stable employer rates. It would be great if I could tell an employer, here is your contribution rate for a long period of time, and you can plan accordingly. The problem is that you have to balance that desire for predictable and stable rates against protecting the funded status of the system. And that's where this variability comes in between the investment returns and how that affects the funded status of the system and whether you then raise contributions quickly enough to recover from a reduction in the earnings side of the equation. So you'd like to be predictable and stable, but unfortunately a big piece of that formula is quite volatile. So that's why contribution rates move around, is to match against that change. Generational equity is another important aspect, and that's to compare how PERS is predicated in theory against other benefit systems. In PERS, I provide services. I'm a public employee. Contributions are made from my salary. Those contributions are set based on an assumption that if I put in this amount of a career, this level of salary, these contributions are paid over time. At the time at which I retire, enough will have been contributed by me and my employers to pay for the benefits that are owed to me. That's called generational equity, when the service is being provided and the funding for those services matches the service of the person actually doing the work. Compare that with Social Security. All of us who pay into Social Security, our contributions do not support our benefits. To Social Security, our contributions support the people who are already receiving benefits in Social Security. That model is predicated on you have a base of people working, making contributions to pay for the smaller base of people that you have who are retired. That is not generationally equitable. My work doesn't pay for me. My work pays for the people who came before me in Social Security. In PERS, my work should pay for my benefit. That's not a value judgment. It's not like one is better or worse than the other. It's just a comparison of generational equity and why that's the reason that we set the rates that we do. And as you'll see, given the legacy costs that we have, you've given me so much to preview. Given the legacy costs that we have, you'll see why this generational equity is a real challenge when you look at assessing the employer contribution rates that are being charged today and into the future. Lastly, of course, we want to be actuarially sound and GASB compliant, but doesn't everybody? So those are important. So how does the PERS board deal with that predictable and stable rates? The PERS board has a policy that's called a rate collar. What the rate collar does is it limits the amount that the employer contribution rate will change from one biennium to the next. And it is a policy of the PERS board. In other words, it's not something that you guys wrote in a law and they follow. It is an effort by the PERS board to impose some sort of stability and consistency across rate changes over time. So the rate collar says that the maximum change is 20% of the rate currently in effect. So if the employer is paying 20% of payroll as their employer contribution rate, the next biennium, the most their rate is going to go up is 20% of 20%, or 4%. So the rate cannot go up higher than from 20 to 24. And then the next biennium, if there's carryover, it's another 20%, so from 24 to 28.8. So the rate collar constrains how much changes from one biennium to the next 20% of the rate. That is, that limit is applied only so long as the funded status for that employer is 70%. Funded status means, again, that comparison of their liability to their assets available to pay benefits, 70%. They have to be at least 70% funded. If they drop below 70, the collar starts to widen. It's not a cliff. It gradually widens down to a funded status of 60%, where the collar doubles. 40% of your rate is the limit. The reason being, again, balancing predictable stable rates against protecting funded status of the system. Once you drop below 70% funded, and if you're moving down to 60, you need to be making more contributions and larger contributions faster to keep that funded status protected. Once you drop below a certain point, you just don't have a big enough base to ever grow out of. So the rate collar is a policy by the PERS board and limits the amount of increase for an individual employer, meaning every employer is assessed individually from one biennium to the next. Helps with that, helps constrain that volatility.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Steve, how many years are we rate collared today?
As you'll see on Monday, the rate collar, because of the large increase in unfunded liability that has come from all the factors we'll review on Monday, the rate collar is constraining employer rate changes for this current, for the next biennium, 17-19, probably almost certainly for 19-21, and under almost any set of return assumptions, probably also 21-23. Once we get to 23-25, if everything goes to assumption, meaning we get returns over that time that are at assumption, we'll probably be at the actual rate that we should be. And I will go through in much more detail Monday about the math of that.
Yeah, because I have questions about that.
Okay, so that's the rate collar. The other thing that that we can talk about in terms of what the PERS board has discretion over and other levers that can be pushed is what's called amortization. So we assess the B and the C plus C. We know we have more in liability than we did in assets. So that's called an unfunded actuarial liability, or UAL. Unfunded, I don't have the money, actuarial projection of the liability, UAL. The PERS board currently finances that UAL over 20 years, assuming we will make our assumed rate of 7.5%, and on what's called a level percent of payroll. So it's assessed as a rate that will be applied to payroll over those 20 years. Now, payroll is going to grow over those 20 years. We assume payroll will grow every year 3.5%. So the actual dollar amount that you pay towards UAL goes up over that 20-year period because it's the same percent of payroll, but the payroll base is growing. So what the slope of that curve shows or results in an amortization of the UAL over 20 years is this green part of this graph, where you start out, and this is looking at what the pattern would look like if we amortize our UAL from 2015. As a level percent of pay, 7.5% interest, 3.5% salary growth, you see that over the 20 years, that green UAL gets amortized down to nothing. Again, everything else going to assumption. So that's a 20-year amortization. But that means that you have to pay more today to amortize the UAL than if you paid it over 25 years. Look at your home mortgage. You've probably looked at least considered a 30-year mortgage on your home. Why don't you have a 10-year mortgage on your home? You pay it off faster, but the payments are much higher. So what you might want to consider to lower your current costs for PERS is extending the amortization period. But there's a consequence to that, and that's what these charts illustrate. If instead you go from a 20-year amortization, which is the green line or green area, you go out to a 30-year amortization, which is the crosshatched. Because the payment is on a level percent of payroll and will grow over time, a 30-year amortization does not start to reduce your unfunded liability for 20 years. Your liability continues to grow. It's what's called negative amortization. Your debt keeps getting bigger because you're not making principal payments fast enough. So a 30-year amortization, yeah, the payments are less, but you don't make a dent in what you owe for about 20 years. 25-year amortization, again, it's about 10 years before you start eating away at what you owe. And if you look at the next slide, as to the total dollar cost of that, that total amortization cost in the 20-year period is $44 billion. If instead you extended it out to 30 years, it's $63 billion, half again as much almost. So again, you make smaller payments, but you make it for a longer time. And for the period of time that you're not reducing the unfunded liability, you're vulnerable to any sort of market downturn or other change in the liabilities that increases that unfunded liability. So this is why the PERS board has picked what is admittedly a rather conservative unfunded actuarial liability amortization period of 20 years. When a UAL emerges, as it did in 2015, we amortize that off over a relatively short period because we want to make sure we're paying down basically the principal as quickly as we can. The only other point on the amortization in the UAL is every valuation, if it produces a unique UAL from that valuation, gets amortized 20 years. So the employer rates we have today, yes, the UAL will be paid off over 20 years. That's assuming, again, everything goes to assumption and no new UAL emerges in the meantime, which would, again, get amortized over 20 years. So if in 2021 and 2022 we had a down market year that generated a UAL, that UAL gets amortized over 20 years. So solving the formula, B equals C plus E, what has the Supreme Court told us about what we can do? I'm not your lawyer. You have legislative counsel. I will tell you what I understand from my lawyers, which is Department of Justice. The Morrow Court decision fundamentally changed the conversation we can have around PERS reform. Prior to the Morrow decision, going back to the 2003 reforms, the Supreme Court had said PERS is a contract. Some elements of that contract can be changed. Some elements of that contract cannot. We're not going to tell you which ones are which until you, the legislature, change some of those elements. And then when you present them to us, we'll tell you if it was something you could or could not have changed. So in the Strzok decision, which reviewed the 2003 PERS reforms, many of those reforms were upheld by the Supreme Court, such as diverting contributions out of the member account into the IAP, such as limiting tier one crediting to the assumed rate and creating a rate guarantee reserve for that excess crediting. Others were not. One of the concepts or one of the reforms that was adopted was a lifetime 8% crediting, so that you could get to the point of that excess crediting in the 80s and 90s. The Supreme Court said, no, each of those was individual decisions of crediting. You can't average those over time. So in 2003, the court said, yeah, to some, not so much to others. The Morrow Court unanimously said, still a contract, but we're going to analyze it completely differently, at least, again, in my simplistic view. What they said was, you cannot change any of the benefits earned up to the date of the legislation. So legislation that came in from 2013, which said we're going to reduce the cost of living adjustment going forward for everybody, the Supreme Court said you cannot affect people who were already receiving COLA for the benefits that they earned prior to that legislation. So if members were retired and getting COLA, you could not reduce their COLA. For all of us that had some benefit earned up to the point of the legislation, we have to get 2% COLA on that, and then the reduced COLA for benefits earned after that date. So the court, again, in my view, created a very clear line which says that the benefits earned up to the date of the legislation cannot be reduced. You can only reduce benefits going forward. So in terms of that balance of the B, C, and E, when we looked at that in 2015 and we said there's an unfunded liability of $21.8 billion, that was the unfunded liability as of 12/31/2015. There is no law that you can pass that makes that number smaller because those were the benefits earned up to that date. You can reduce benefits going forward and reduce the cost of those benefits so that more money or enough money can go to pay for the $21.8 billion that's already earned, but you cannot reduce that $21.8 billion. That's, again, my read of the court's review. I know Senator Taylor, Chair Taylor, you're having your counsel come in and talk more about it in terms of the concepts.
Yeah, we're inviting legislative counsel. I know I appreciate your giving the perspective. We just want to, you know, of course, we'll have, thank you for including that. We're going to have LC also come in next week to go over that just so we have multiple viewpoints.
So what I would leave you with today is as the things to be considered are what I'm trying to boil down to the basic principles of PERS reform. And they are these. Remembering that formula, benefits equals contributions plus earnings. The only way you're going to reduce total cost for a retirement system is reducing benefits. The only way you make the C or the E go down is if the B goes down too. So whatever you may be thinking about in terms of how do we reduce the costs of PERS, the only way to reduce the cost of the system is to reduce the benefits being paid, or to be paid, I should say. Secondly, any reduction in benefits will no doubt be challenged in court. So it will be difficult to construct any sort of concept that doesn't end up across the street under the court's review because, again, to be effective, you have to reduce benefits. You reduce benefits that somebody's expecting. You take away something that a person thinks they're entitled to, you will get sued. So most concept bills include a direct referral to the Supreme Court. We've worked through that process before. Lastly, and this is where the generational equity piece comes in, and we'll get into much more detail on the numbers of it, but lastly, because of that Supreme Court decision, the benefits you reduce are only on service and benefits to be earned. So you're reducing the benefits of people in the system continuing to be employed to pay for the benefits of people who have already gone. So again, the other reason I like talking about math is you can't have an opinion about math, you know. And so I'm not trying to put a value judgment on that. I'm just trying to explain, at least as far as the system dynamic goes, only way to save costs is reduce benefits. You're going to get sued. And you're reducing the benefits of the people yet to work because of the unaffordability of the benefits of people already out the door.
Okay,
Chair Taylor, that's where I expected to get on the first day, leaving you on a high note.
Okay, so as I said at the beginning, we're going to have a the PERS agency has a full presentation. We've broken it into phase one, you know, part one, part two. So he's going to continue on Monday for those who would like to come back, but I think we're going to take this moment to see if any of the committee members have any questions.
Just Senator a question Moses. Regarding, we can't see if it's constitutional or not unless we pass something. I don't want to pass something that's illegal and then find out that, I think that we just want to avoid any lengthy and expensive lawsuit. So we rely on our legislative counsel to tell us. I can't remember when we were going through PERS reform or not. Did they actually say our legislation that we passed before was legal?
Chair Taylor, Senator Mona Sanderson, I think that the opinions have certainly varied over time, and I think the construct of those opinions was much harder before the current court's direction. I think now, at least again in my view, and I think legislative counsel's analysis is pretty similar to this, the changes you're contemplating have to only be for benefits earned going forward. So to that degree, I think the analysis is easier and more predictable, but I don't wear a black robe for a living.
Well, it's just hard for me to want, I mean, that's not going to have much effect for benefits here forward. That means people that are under the system right now, correct?
Correct. And yet to come.
And that's frustrating for me because as a single mom back in the 80s when I took my job, I didn't go for a $60,000 job in a hospital. I'm a retired public health nurse. I went for a $30,000 job in public health because they gave good benefits. And another reason, because I could be home. It was an 8-to-5 job rather than working, so I could be home with my kids. So if we keep hurting, it's not going to make much difference then if we affect benefits for Tier 2 or Tier 3, correct, in the long run on what employers are having to pay now. We'd be reducing our benefits so low that no one's going to want to be a public employee anymore.
And Chair Taylor, Senator Romano Sanderson, you'll see a lot of the numbers driving that on Monday.
Okay.
And it is the struggle, of course, that you have as the plan sponsors and the drivers of the benefit. It's why we've been talking with Senator Canope through at least the last couple legislative sessions on the development of concepts and what the air effect might be. And it's also why I've spent about the last 15 months trying to get our employers that basic understanding of what's driving the conversation today and why, for example, I'm here today. I'm trying to set that groundwork and that realization, and then where the decision goes from there is your very difficult job.
Okay, yes, Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned earlier in the presentation that any of the concepts that we looked at would be assessed in terms of the impact they would have on the number of people that are coming through the doors. Do you have information based on past changes of how many people accelerated their plan to retirement based on a change? I know that's a letter. I've gotten so many letters from people in my community saying, I want to know if I should retire by the end of the year. Is the legislature going to do anything with PERS? I wasn't planning to do it for another 5 or 10 years, but if you're taking action, I want to retire. And I imagine that's replicated frequently.
It is, Chair Taylor, Senator Gelser. Our three highest years of retirements were 2003, 2011, and 2013. Mm-hmm. Because exactly that. And it is frustrating, certainly for people trying to make a very important decision on their retirement. And the frustration is compounded by the fact that my member information people can't tell you what the legislature is going to do or what the effect might be.
Follow up?
Yes, Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would it be possible to get those numbers from those years to compare year over year and what the cost impact was? Or is that in the big packet?
It's
here?
In PERS by the numbers.
In PERS by the numbers. All right. Which is not the PowerPoint.
Now the cost impact is not, but the number of people who retired in each year are.
It would be great if that was available, the cost number, and how that stacked up to the savings that we were trying to achieve.
Chair Taylor, Senator Gelser, that's more of a challenge because it's really an individual determination. Okay. So, for example, in 2003, let's say that in 2003, when people went out, we did a comparison of whether your benefit would be higher under the old rules or the new rules, and you got the higher of the two. In 2011 and 13, for example, a lot of people that went out because some of the conversations were around money match. Those people are all paid for in the sense that their account balances are already in. So they don't cost any more if they retire today, tomorrow, or the next day. So anyway, that's more, the savings is more of a challenge.
Thank you.
Okay, so I just want to take a moment to go back to, so thank you very much. If you could just wait one moment in case someone has a question. At the beginning, I talked about a memo that Senator Canope and I put out last Friday. And in this memo, it lays out what the criteria that will be used to evaluate PERS proposals, because as you can see, this is a complicated issue, and there are a lot of factors to take into consideration, and we want to be mindful of the fact that something that could pass could possibly end up in the court system. It could end up really not necessarily saving any money, although it may sound good at the beginning, but then upon further analysis, it isn't actually going to create some sort of savings. So just for those who don't have access to OLIS or haven't had a chance to look at that, the criteria is around, is it constitutional? What's the order of magnitude in the savings? The actuarial soundness of the proposal, the impact on employer contribution rates, impact on state and local budgets, which can't be forgotten, the impact on public employee benefits, the impact on public employee workforce, and which kind of talks about, you know, when people want to come in to be part of the system, and et cetera, the equitability of costs and benefits to public employees, and then the administrative feasibility of some of the ideas. And so we are encouraging folks, if they have bills, concepts, you'll see if you're following the agenda, Senator Knoop has some bills that he's already introduced. There have been some other bills that have been introduced, and yesterday I sent out a memo via the committee chair to my colleagues in the House and the Senate that have bills that they would like to have heard, saying please go ahead and look at this memo that we've sent out with the criteria, basically handing the bills back to our colleagues, saying look at them, see if they meet the criteria, and if they think that they meet the litmus test and could withstand this kind of vetting, then yes, go ahead and bring those bills forward. So I just want to have that on the record so everyone understands where we're going with this conversation, so that everybody, all bills will be treated equally. So all bills that come through this committee, we will hold them to this criteria, and all that will be brought out into the public light so everyone can see what we're grappling with here and the different issues that we have to face. So with that being said, I don't know if there's any other questions or anything like that. So thank you very much. You did a great job, as always. Are we all done here? Now, 1 second here.
I'm
going
to
go. Oh, yes. I'm so sorry, Senator Hansel.
Do we anticipate we'll do any other bills other than PERS this year?
In this committee.
In this committee? Yes, we're going to hear about equal pay. Senator Hansel, you know, women have been underpaid for quite some time. We're going to do something about that. How does that sound? Does that sound pretty good? Yeah. Okay, great. So I'm going to go ahead and close the informational hearing on PERS. Thank you all for coming.